everyone's agenda. So I really worry about what the chances are of selecting a random sample of people to discuss this issue and allowing people to think outside of the common paradigm that they're already in. And I think even if you enlist, like the example on Citizens Assembly showed, even if you enlist professors to provide information on the variety of topics, I think that a lot of research represents what is the normal paradigm, so it would not represent adequate research on alternative, radical alternative propositions. What do we do? Help.
Use Wikipedia. Which is my paper topic. I don't know. I mean, that was a joke, but I think that there is a genuine erosion of the monopoly of corporate structures over the ability to get information to people, and it's still the overwhelming majority of information that people have access to is filtered from some sort of corporate interest or another. But I think the potential for alternatives is there, and it's mostly in the internet and through social networks. So I take the point, but I'm not. From what I read, your view is very cynical. Or very skeptical. Skeptical, not cynical.
Well, I just think, if you think of the resource distribution in universities, as an example, or in school of agriculture, most research is still on the pro-productivist paradigm, which is what we're living in agriculture right now. And so a representative sample of information across that wouldn't provide you with really insight into alternative agricultural production modes. And when you have society that goes in and is also, representative of that way of thought to a large extent, because that's what you're used to hearing all the time, there's not much wiggle room for new ideas to take shape.
I think Kathy's pointing to a very important tension as well in the idea of wanting large participation, but wanting informed participation. And I think that is a great problem. So I think we have to think of a phase of this as conscientization, or that process. And that has to be inherent, I think, in the process of change. How we do it, I don't know. Where we get the information from, I don't know. But I think that's a very important part of it. So I think we have to think of how to disseminate the correct information, or at least unbiased information, to the public for such things.
But the question of who does that is what's...
We are talking about the random assembly or just citizen assembly?
Well, I think, I mean, the problem of the information around which democratic decisions get made applies, of course, to any structure of democratic decision-making, whether it be a random assembly, as in the Citizens' Assembly, thinking of that as a model that could be applied to other decision areas, or a participatory assembly, as in the participatory budget, or for that matter, simply a revamped electoral democracy where you have elected officials who are more accountable to their constituencies. You still have the same problem of on what information basis are the constituents evaluating and holding accountable their representatives. So for any, I think any model of democracy runs up against this question of information. It's not peculiar to a more participatory form of democracy. And so one issue for us to think about is, first of all, is this a more pressing problem the more ordinary citizens are involved in democratic politics as opposed to elites? So one view is an advantage of having an elitist polyarchy, as it's called, rather than a participatory democracy, is because elites are likely to be operating under better information conditions. That's one view. The more you give power to the people, the more the shaky information upon which people act becomes a problem, is this view. So rather than just say it's a problem, which it is, of course it is. I mean, I don't mean at all to be dismissive of it. Let's try to give it more specificity as a problem with respect to these designs and what solutions to those problems might be connected to the these more radical democratic designs that we talked about in this chapter.
Can I make an interjection?
Yeah.
And this is something I talked about in my interrogation for this week, but I think we also have to stop thinking about information sharing from the top down. I mean, generally, we can think of all the kinds of information that elites, professionals, whatever, have, but we also have to think about the information that communities have to share with elites. They have that local knowledge. They have the knowledge of living in those realities every day. I think it takes a theoretical shift to think about we're not how knowledge is shared, rather than just.
And that's, I mean, that's in fact one of the arguments for at least the participatory democratic problem-solving strategy. One of the arguments in favor of it is that it actually produces better decisions because of impacted local knowledge, even under the problems of distorted information. That is, you're still making an improvement relative to alternatives. And that kind of problem-solving capacity is one of the reasons why things like the Porto Alegre Participatory Budget Scheme are seen as so desirable by institutions which we normally think of as quite anti-democratic, and like the World Bank. The World Bank holds up, and this is an argument in favor of Ricardo's view, right? The World Bank holds up Porto Alegre as a model city, and the participatory budget as a model way of getting rid of corruption. And then some people say, well, that shows that we shouldn't do it because the World Bank likes it. It may, however, just reveal a deeply contradictory character of politics and democracy under capitalist conditions, that there are these conflicting requirements, efficiency as well as participation. And it turns out in this particular occasion, you can bring these more participatory forms together with an increased efficiency. But the argument for that, a lot of that has to do with impacted local knowledge and the ability to make, to engage in more creative and effective problem solving when that information gets mobilized from below. Hi, Eduardo.
Hi. Well, you raised the point in the discussion of the EPG model, too, that that's particularly the case when you're doing the pragmatic, right, like kind of local, more pragmatic, concrete types of transformations rather than wholesale radical transformation. So you might, at that level, Catherine's problem kind of comes in terms of do you have
like if you can't get by the logic that defines how you define your problems.
Right. And when you're talking about large and radical, like structural changes of social systems or economic systems, is there a problem there still? Yes.
Well, it seems to be a problem on at least two different levels. The first is that poor people don't have the time, energy, and money to acquire the sort of basic information that would be necessary to make pragmatic decisions, which might be an argument for some sort of elite or technocratic participation in decision making. But I think there's also a lot of evidence that people of every class can get extremely excited about sharing information and generating information and, you know, all these sorts of things. And the second problem is that there are these ideological constraints, the sort of like horse blinders that would see you, that would prevent you from perceiving genuinely radical alternatives that may be more desirable but simply aren't on people's radar, which I think is the point Kathy was raising, more than the problem of practical decision making.
Well, and it's sort of interesting that a lot of times spectacular leaders have been seen as the avant-garde in what they were doing, which clearly meant they didn't have, in a sense, they didn't have the support to do what they achieved at the time when they started initiating.
But I think to get rid of the blinders, to get past that, if we're dealing with this in a pragmatic fashion, then I think that the citizens' assemblies could be a way in that it can empower people. If I think the current system doesn't encourage people to think about, like what Charity was saying about how their own knowledge and their own interests can be incorporated into policy, and if they're given that opportunity, they will start actively thinking more about, you know, their community that they live in, and eventually to larger contexts. But I think, and thinking about an alternative to what exists now, I think that's better than what exists.
Yeah. I think Molly's point is a pretty fundamental one. And it's really worth giving some thought to in terms of what one might think of as a sociology of information conditions. There's an old idea in political science around voter ignorance called the rational ignorance model, which basically says that a rational person prefers to remain ignorant because it takes time and effort and sometimes expenses to acquire information, and the information is useless because they don't have any power. So if you're disempowered, unless you happen to be a peculiar kind of person, an intellectual who just enjoys information. So, you know, we're all intellectuals, so we actually enjoy getting information, and it isn't a cost. It's a pleasure to do research. It's a pleasure to read lots of newspapers and find out what's really going on. And if anything, it's a cost to remain ignorant. Well, that's a very peculiar kind of person, and there's no reason why everybody should be an intellectual in that sense. I mean, ideas are fun, but fishing can be fun for some people, I'm told. So the thing, the rational ignorance argument says, so long as people don't have a strong reason to feel that it matters to have good information, then they'll just take whatever the cheapest information. And it's cheap information which makes people vulnerable to manipulation by powerful actors. So one idea of both the citizens' assembly kind of model, which could be applied in all sorts of settings other than the one studied, you know, in the chapter, but perhaps even more the direct democracy participatory processes like participatory budgets, is once people believe these are real and not just phony, so once the cynicism barrier is overcome and there's a belief that these really are empowered, then I think people's desire for good information and their willingness to check it out to be sure it's good at least will lead to a better terrain around which, for example, an agricultural activist like you, Catherine, you know, do you go by Catherine or Kathy, by the way, in terms of everyday discussion? Catherine-y. you know, that is the possibility. For example, one can imagine a food council in a developing on empowered participatory grounds, that there are food policy issues in a city, and you could have councils that are organized around trying to figure out the best way to do things. And, of course, agribusiness is going to be trying to influence that they'll be providing information. But that would be a setting within which the credibility of at least some oppositional views might be greater, because the incentive for people to actually hear what you're saying would be greater. So maybe the information problem, however important it is more easily grappled with from the vantage point of social movements and struggles for good information if it intersects these kinds of institutional designs, as opposed to having to solve the information problem first in order for these designs to work.
Well, I can see it working in a cyclical fashion much more successfully than a one-shot deal. Because for the Citizens Assembly example, all I can think is it wasn't the topic of the type of representation in Canada had been on the agenda for a while when that happened. So it wasn't like people were going from scratch and saying, wait, how do we improve a democratic system? Oh, we come up with this. People were like, there's a few options for how we could improve the democratic system. Which option should we go for? And that's always that's already a much more advanced idea in time, and one that's not like, our system works, what are you talking about? It's fine. Like, there's a huge shift between that, and I think it worked really well for that, and I don't know how it would work when you didn't have that, maybe we need to think about this context.
There's an interesting, just as a bit of the history of the British Columbia Citizens Assembly, an interesting outcome was the proposal for electoral reform that actually came out of the Citizens' Assembly was not the proposal favored by the experts. Now, the information that the Assembly members had was descriptive information about all the extant systems. Mm-hmm. So they did not get discussions of novel electoral rules other than those that have been tried. Mm-hmm. I think they had 8 systems that they looked at. So maybe they've left out something that would have been even better than the ones they had. I'm not sure. I mean, one can criticize electoral representative democracy altogether and say you don't even want it, you want something else. But at least it was my sense that the range of possible electoral systems that was discussed was pretty comprehensive. Mm-hmm. And I myself can't think of anything that would be outside of that spectrum that would have been a credible design, given that you want an electoral system, you know, mm-hmm. given that that was what was being discussed. But the single transferable vote system, which they chose, was not the one that the Electoral Commission of Canada, which was, you know, this yeah. committee that had met and made, yeah. they wanted more of a conventional proportional representation system. And the Green Party strongly opposed the single transferable vote system. They preferred a conventional proportional representation system.
On what grounds did they oppose it?
They opposed it because it slightly weakens political parties.
Right.
That is, in a standard proportional representation system, the political parties determine the voter list, and they determine the place of candidates on the list. So if you have an 8-member district and you're doing proportional representation, the party chooses 8 people to be candidates for that party, and then ranks them from number 1 to number 8. And if the party gets 100% of the vote, or I guess if it gets whatever...
If it gets 50%, the first 4 people on
right,
the
list. Right,
all
right. So you don't have to get 100% to get all 8. You probably yeah. have to get about 85% or something mm-hmm. to get all 8. So if you get 50, you get the top 4. Voters don't vote for people. They just vote for parties. In the single transferable vote system, voters vote for individual candidates. And you can vote for 3, so if you have an 8-member district, you vote for 8 candidates, but you could vote for 4 Greens and 2 Social Democrats and 2 Conservatives if you wanted to. You just vote for candidates.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Which has the effect of creating a kind of competition among the candidates within a party, mm-hmm. as well as between parties. Now, the argument for that is it makes the candidates themselves more accountable to the electorate, not just the party, because they have to win personal confidence, and it reduces the power of party leaders to decide who's going to get elected. So if a party knows that they're going to get enough votes to get one person elected, they can put some party hack as number 1. This way they can't do that. And therefore it weakens parties. Well, the good citizens of British Columbia who had never heard of a single transferable vote system, this was new information. They did not know that such things existed. Yeah. Most of the 160 random delegates. Once they figured all these things out and began debating it, their general cynicism about political parties in Canada, I mean, everywhere, people have that kind of cynicism, felt that they wanted the people to have a more direct role mm-hmm. in choosing the politicians. But that has the effect of weakening parties, and I think there's a trade-off. You know, you want strong parties because parties serve a ideological function of developing ideas and programs and whatever, and weakening parties can just make every candidate scrambling to be popular in a sort of making wild promises kind of sense, and it can reduce the discipline of a party around a set of programs. So, you know, there are risks involved mm-hmm. in both. But this is just with respect to the information issue. In this particular case, the information does not seem to have been that effectively manipulated by the experts to get what they wanted.
Well, I think in this case, but that's the thing, is in this case I don't think the need for that change was so much in doubt. so that it didn't seem radical to be proposing to people to rethink the voting system. Whereas if 20 years ago you had said, here's 10 people, let's rethink the voting system, maybe people, like, it would have been before their, before that issue had really come up as something that was pressing.
But I think what was radical is that, like, the however number of, like, 160 people were handpicked randomly. Mm-hmm. Whereas you could have had instead like a chamber, like just a committee of experts that would have said, well, we're just gonna do some theoretical work.
Oh no,
work
and I
that.
Totally appreciate that part.
And I mean, you need some way of letting people get these new great ideas. So I think that's what part of this does serve, is a way for like of access for anyone to pose new problems that's directly dealing. So instead of like interest groups putting pressure on parties and politicians, they can, you know, pitch their case to these assemblies, or which could have negative consequences too. But
it's funny because it's ironic, because in this case it came up because interest groups had pitched their case, and it was just, it's just a, like,
right,
just the mechanism itself that I'm talking about, not the.
Right.
Todd, you had.
I mean, it's in, first of all, it matters what is being decided.
Speak
on.
Up so that they can.
Yeah. I also have a cold, so I apologize for my croakiness. But, I mean, if you imagine a citizens' assembly that's empowered to empowered to rewrite the sort of property rights legislation in a country, it's hard
or
to.
Or economic
imagine,
regulation.
Or whatever. It's hard to imagine that they would, you know, choose to decide upon the socialization of the means of production, you know, if this were enacted in British Columbia next week. So it kind of matters what the, you know, in this case, it's not off the table in some sense that the electoral system might be reformed in the same way it's off the table that the property rights regime might be reformed. So that was sort of the first comment. The second comment is that it seems like there's sort of a fine line between saying, well, you know, we want radical democracy, but we want our radical democracy to decide upon radical things, right? And, well, I don't know what the fine line is, but the point is that, I mean, it's kind of like, to be a little snarky, it's kind of like the United States saying, well, we want democracy in the Middle East as long as they don't elect Hamas, right? I mean, we want democracy, but only if it's going to do the right things. It seems like that's just kind of part of the package with democracy. Sometimes you get the, you know, you don't know what the outcome is going to be, and that sort of, it's part of the fun, right? And then the last thing was, it's not just an information problem, I think, but it's also sort of a, you could say, a cognition problem, or it's what kinds of people have the sort of habitudes to actually deliberate. So, for example, in Boston, I think there were these panels that were empowered to make decisions about how recombinant DNA research was going to be done because of all these safety concerns and all this kind of stuff. And so they had these panels. And of course, what ended up happening was that the doctor and the engineer and the philosopher who were on the panel kind of dominated, and the people that had, you know, there was a nurse and a teacher or something like that. And they were sort of, you know, not deliberately shut out, but they just didn't feel as sort of entitled to contribute, given that there were these people that had sort of professional credentials and so on and so forth. And so that's not a question of who has the information, but who sort of feels entitled to kind of contribute and deliberate and you know, is accustomed to this kind of environment where you speak in front of a group of people and you know not everybody is comfortable doing that, but they have interests as well.
So, and there's two different issues that you've, more than two, raised here. On the second question, it's again a bit like the information problem itself. That is, of course it's a problem that people with a lot of education, a lot of cultural capital, with a strong sense of entitlement to speak are more likely to speak in any deliberative forum. So whether you have direct democracy, town hall meetings, public hearings, in any venue where speaking matters, people who are good at it and feel comfortable at it are going to do more of it. and that works against the egalitarian premises of a deep democracy. But different terrains of democratic institutions make it easier or harder to fight against that. They create a more favorable environment within which we can engage in a set of practices to move towards a more egalitarian form of listening and of speaking, and in which the actual inequalities in the skills are transformed, so that people who were initially shy and hesitant and unself-confident become self-confident because they engage in settings where they can do so at a lower risk, and then they become better at it. So one argument for the empowered participatory governance model, the kind of participatory budgeting, for example, is that it actually increased the self-confidence of large sectors of the population, demographic sectors. I don't mean large numbers of people, but people from a much more diverse set of milieu. It increased their capacity to participate actively and stand up and say things and be heard and to learn how to do it well. You know, to stand up and speak in a garbled and incoherent way, of course, one should not, the listener should not take that as seriously as somebody who gives an articulate set of reasons for an argument. The whole point of deliberation is to move towards consensus through giving good reasons. And if some people give only garbled doctrines rather than reasons, for good reason they're not listened to as well. But I would make the same general point that I made about information, that I think that these more participatory democratic settings and the more egalitarian democratic forms, and I consider the Citizens' Assembly an egalitarian form because ordinary people are the decision makers within it, are the settings within which some movement against this problem becomes plausible, as opposed to those are settings where this problem becomes even worse. If it was the case that these were the settings where it became even worse, that would be a real criticism of them, as opposed to a statement of a problem that has to be dealt with within them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I was just making the point that I think it's a somewhat, it's the things that we were talking about are information problems, but they're not just information.
Right.
They're partially information problems, but they're partly about how people are used to dealing with and processing and using information.
So more generally on this first proposal, the Athenian model of democracy, basically, where randomly selected citizens are empowered with respect to some domain of problems, which could range from the full gambit. One could imagine, for example, a citizens' assembly as a second house of parliament. So rather than have a second house of parliament being a house of lords, you know, hereditary nobilities, or a house of experts, or of notables, the current British House of Lords is a house of notables. People get appointed for life because of their notable qualities of whatever sort. You could have a second assembly that was a house of citizens, a citizen assembly, randomly selected, and it could be the countervailing power to the House of Politicians, the main parliament, and which it would be deliberating on the full range of things that legislative bodies deliberate on. Or it could be, as in the Citizens' Assembly for Electoral Reform in British Columbia, a highly targeted policy jury to decide some particular matter of public importance. So my question then would be, overall, do you think this is a good idea? Do you think it's something that should be incorporated into political programs and then refined through debate? Or do you think that basically this is a distraction, a kind of unlikely to be a very productive and fruitful way of thinking about a rejuvenated and expanded democracy? That's my... Now, the big question, what's your bottom line on this one? Maybe. That's a good... I like these decisive answers. You know. Maybe.
I think that's the issue, though. It sounds like a really good way to go forward as long as you ensured you had a mechanism in place that would continually look for weaknesses as opposed to putting that mechanism, I mean, putting a certain form in place and realizing it doesn't work so well, but keeping it because it works so well for these people, which is sort of how every institution has ever gone wrong, like, that we thought were good, is because it hasn't been able to continually be self-critical and adapt. And so I think almost that second, that mechanism is really key.
Roxana, is Roxana there? Yeah. I think you expressed some skepticism specifically about random selection and its effect on, I liked your figure, your expression, honest fighters.
Okay. Can I speak in Spanish?
Do we have a volunteer interpreter here?
Okay,
I'm out today.
Okay, Rodolfo will be your mouthpiece.
I'll try to do better.
Gracias, Rodolfo. Lo que yo planteaba eran dos problemas. En primer lugar, no veía que esta elección al azar pudiera elegir a personas que representen a minorías o que pudieran llegar a tener una representación en real en los problemas.
Okay.
Okay, well, the first problem I see is that this random selection wouldn't allow for representation of minorities as well as other forms. Dale.
The second problem is about the honest fighters. Lo que yo planteaba era que eliminaba de alguna manera la posibilidad de que las personas capacitadas e interesadas en luchar por algún problema específico pudieran en la lucha cotidiana demostrar su idoneidad.
Okay.
Well, the second problem is that how these honest fighters that are more capable and interested in changing the world, let's say, or fighting for just causes, how would they make it to this kind of assembly? Because the random selection would not take that into account. ¿Listo?
Yes, it's okay.
Okay. Two things, the minorities and the...
Okay, so what do you think? There's the two issues, that a random assembly does not give adequate voice to minorities of one sort or another. And the second is a particularly eager and effective popular leader who is an honest fighter doesn't have any chance particularly to get selected. I mean, it could happen, but of course, what's your reaction to that as with respect to this design as a...
I think the second problem... Does someone else want to say something?
No, go.
I think the second problem could be overcome by the fact that if he's a leader, he influences
he
people.
Or she.
Yes. She influences people around her, and those people become followers. And it's not in that leader's interest necessarily to be the one elected. Because if there's people who agree with that person, then they can get elected to the system.
And well, not elected.
Or not elected, selected. And I just know when I was in Senegal, even though it was a democratic system, people were trying often to get people who would run to become supporters of the farmers' movement, regardless of which party they were in, so that when they were elected, they had those ideals with them. So you can have ideals, and I think it's almost stronger when you don't have the whole, or how should I say, when you have more people supporting an idea than if you just had one person. And in the, like, I don't think that would necessarily stop ideas from passing through. Of course, that's opposite of what I said earlier, but I...
So it pushes the kind of honest fighters, the realm in which for their activity
is
into civil society rather
yeah.
than trying to get elected.
That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. So, and there's that...
It seems like the issue we're dancing around is that, well, not really dancing around, but not quite fully saying, is that it doesn't seem like a random selection or a demographically targeted random selection, so that you can, you know, get representation of minorities, but within those minorities, people are still randomly selected. Even if you have a fair representation, like a slice of your society in your citizens' assembly, it doesn't seem like a citizens' assembly is a good mechanism for creating the type of fundamental or radical social change that people in this room happen to be interested in. So a citizens' assembly doesn't seem like a fruitful mechanism for any sort of transition towards a more real utopian world. It is a way to make representation more fair in certain senses of the word fair within any sort of democratic process, but it makes it better, but it doesn't get it to where we want it to go.
Okay, so let me make a couple of comments on starting with this last point and then segueing from there to the honest fighter problem. In a lot of the real utopian proposals that we'll be discussing, the issue is not necessarily how does this help us move further towards a socially empowered world, but is itself a constituent part of a socially empowered world. So the idea of a random assembly, of the Athenian model, is that in our ideal democracy, we might want citizens' assemblies of this sort, because it would help us solve some of the problems of democratic equality that we want to solve, and it's a design element of the actually empowered world we want. And so by putting it in place in whatever form we can now, what we're actually doing is prefiguring the design elements of a more fully democratic society. Even if this particular design element isn't by itself going to generate new legislation that's going to further push us along, right? It is just a prefigurative component of what we want. Now, I think a good case can be made that if we could snap our fingers and have the imaginary world we want, we might well want to have random citizens' assemblies as a component in it. And I can think of lots of ways that that might be useful, aside from the ones we've just talked about, you know. And if that's true, if this is actually a design element of the kind of institutions we want in a world of deep and radical and egalitarian democracy, then that seems to me sufficient for it to be part of our reform project to create such institutions now, unless it were the case that in so doing we would weaken the chance for further progress. So if it falls to the Ricardo problem, which we'll discuss later, that it actually becomes an impediment to further movement, well, that's an argument for not doing it, even if it's inherently something we would think would be a good thing to do. My general perspective on these things is that if we are smart enough to figure out some of the design elements we want in the future transcendent world, the world that transcends and goes beyond capitalism, if we know some things that we almost for sure want to see present there, and we can manage to build them now, it's almost always going to be a good thing to do. You know, that would be my premise, is that building the new world in the shell of the old, to use the old Wobblies expression, is, whatever else we do, a good thing to do. If nothing else, because it'll demonstrate to people that ordinary citizens, when they're given the incentives and given the power to do things, can make perfectly good practical decisions around even relatively complicated matters. And it certainly transforms the participants. So one of the strongest and most moving things out of the Citizens' Assembly in British Columbia is you had 160 people who, nearly all of whom, felt it was a completely transformative experience in their own lives. I mean, 160 isn't enough to change the world, but still. So I think that's at least, in addition to the criterion, will they make decisions that would also contribute to moving forward? I think we have to ask the question, is the form itself something we want to see created? Now, on the honest fighters issue, if the only form of democratic participation that was made available in the society was the random citizen assembly, I would almost for sure oppose it. You know, I'd have to think about it more. But I think it's almost certainly the case that if this was to replace all other ways of mobilizing and participating and expressing popular democratic power, this was to be the only institution, its negatives would probably outweigh its positives. And the honest fighter problem would be a very important part of that. It would not allow for the cultivation and development of leadership that could play an important galvanizing and organizing role, because they wouldn't have anything to do. But since that's not the idea, the idea here is not to replace social movements and elections and direct democratic councils where you can create those. It's not to replace all those with random assemblies. It's just that the random assembly becomes one institution in an array of democratic institutions. Well, then I don't think the honest fighter problem is necessarily that serious a problem. And furthermore, we could think of modifications of this design which might make it look a little bit more like a jury and less like an assembly. Where, for in a jury, you have a hearing where you have adversaries, lawyers, and often very charismatic and skillful honest fighters, so to speak, or dishonest fighters, who present the case to the jury, and then the jury decides through their deliberation. Well, that wasn't the model of the British Columbia case. It wasn't adversarial. They were just given lots of information in a pedagogical way. They were given both sides, the pros and cons, but it wasn't that you had lawyers representing proportional representation fighting lawyers representing single transferable votes and the assembly being a jury. That wasn't the model. But you could decide that you want a more adversarial model of citizens' assemblies, where the citizens' assemblies here, social movements, interested parties, political parties, presenting the case on some problem, and then they decide, as a jury would. That's a different model, but that would be a model that would allow the honest fighter a direct role, but a role around the mobilization of information and arguments, rather than the role as an empowered member of the assembly. Yeah, Todd. No, I don't.
I wanted to go back to the question you asked earlier about thinking about this as a model for a second house of parliament. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you take that, I mean, just kind of pragmatically, how long would the terms be, and would people have I mean, as it is elected representatives, they have staffs, they have large staff. I mean, the information problem in that case becomes much larger, right? Because the amount of, I mean, an individual cannot process that amount of information. They need somebody else to actually go and gather it, and so on and so forth. So I think that, I don't know, that actually seems to me stretching it a little bit too far. So it seems like there's some model that's less ad hoc and more general than the British Columbia case. But it almost seems, I mean, I guess part of the question would be, do these have to be policy specific? I mean, does it have to be, you know, one particular issue, which might not be a one-off thing, right? It might be some, you know, iterative policy decision. But, you know, once you get to two policies or three policies, that, you know, do the information constraints become just too large to have something like this?
I think there's in a parliamentary system, or Congress or Senate, there's a lot of decision making which is delegated also to the party platform and to the party researchers as much as to the individual person who has his own staff. So in that sense, the decision making is even more huge, and the ability to deliberate on a regular basis on those issues, which, I mean, Senate or Congress doesn't read the text of their bills, so it'd be like, how would you go? that would necessitate an overhaul of the rest of the system too.
So the argument that a citizens' assembly couldn't work because they could not possibly either be expert enough themselves to make good decisions, or there's no way of organizing a technical staff to help them in a way that wouldn't be vulnerable to all sorts of perverse effects, unspecified. That is, I think, very close to saying that citizens themselves are not capable of really being democratically empowered. The most they're capable of doing is selecting people to represent them. That is the argument for a purely representational concept of democracy. Whereas I think there are ways of solving the problem that you... So what you pointed to a problem, information overload and incompetence, that I mean that in the not in the nasty sense, just that there'd be domains of policy around which the individual randomly selected members simply couldn't be competent. And there's, and then the question is there a solution to the support staff problem? In the parliamentary case, the support staff problem is solved by parties. And that would not be an appropriate solution in a citizens' assembly, because the citizens aren't representatives of parties. So those are relevant issues, design questions to be solved. And I think there are ways we could imagine creative solutions to those. And I think it would be interesting to take the provocation of that challenge. How can you have non-experts making these informed, complicated decisions in the absence of programmatic parties as the backup staff for them? In Porto Alegre, around the participatory budget, this came up all the time, this problem. Because ordinary citizens from the neighborhoods, and mostly not very well educated, it's true that the least educated, most marginalized people were underrepresented. But it was not the case that the participatory councils were dominated by university people. They just weren't. They were dominated by ordinary people more or less around the median education. High school educated people were the dominant force in these things. And it was a problem. It was an issue. They didn't have the competence to make decisions about sewers and, you know, roads. I mean, these all have technical aspects. Even the simplest of things in a city around which you're allocating budgets have technical aspects. What Boa Santos has argued is that this problem, in the end, if not solved completely, at least became partially solved by a transformation of the technocracy in the city. And he describes it as a transformation from a techno-bureaucracy to a techno-democracy. That is, the engineers and sanitation specialists became they basically became retrained over time in their capacity to explain things to ordinary people in ways that enabled people to decide among the priorities in a technically informed way without themselves becoming technical experts. So one idea is that ordinary people can really do that if they have the incentives, and if then the support structure is designed to make that possible as opposed to impede that. And another view is just very skeptical about that, saying that that's just way too demanding on what most people's capacities would be, and that you'll just end up with bad and incoherent and consistently suboptimal decisions, rules, laws, regulations coming out of such a process.
I wasn't suggesting that people are capable of that. It just seems like in the case where this is amplified to, you know, a role equivalent to sort of a House of Congress or Parliament, then you just start to think that, well, people would have to be kind of full time at this, and then that would sort of change their relationship to the whole institution, right? Because they wouldn't be going one week every other week.
No, they would be. The idea of the House of Lords idea, that the citizens, the House of Citizens,
yeah,
is that people would serve a 3-year term, be extremely well paid,
right,
so that it would be a big deal. Nobody would be at a financial disadvantage from having been selected. They would, and there'd be all sorts of other supports to make them able to do it. There'd be 3-year terms with one third of the, this was our proposal, you know, I did this with Harry Brighouse, 3-year terms with one third of the Citizens House being selected each year. So you'd have 3 overlapping cohorts. And we envision their role to be similar to the House of Lords, which is they can hold up legislation, send it back for reconsideration, point out its flaws, but they can only do so a certain number of times. I think in the House of Lords it's three times that they can send things back, after which it can be passed. So it's basically a way of the Citizens' Assembly putting a brake on politically driven kinds of legislation that hasn't really taken the will of the people more seriously. But that part of the proposal was just because we were just trying to imagine changing the representational form of the House of Lords, not its other rules. More generally, I don't see any reason why you couldn't have a citizens' house, a House of Citizens, which would function just like the U.S. Senate, in effect. It would just be a different mechanism of representation with co-equal standing with respect to the ability to initiate laws and pass or not pass them.
And legislation is not a full-time job. I mean, those people spend 80% of their time raising money and
Other. Yeah, and these guys wouldn't have to raise any money.
I think to what extent did the Citizens' Assembly, the case study, work because they spent so long talking about one issue and figuring out how to solve that one issue. And for me, that was three-quarters of its strength. It wasn't because they said yes, no to something that was going through. And there's a difference between passing laws and saying yes, no, and like deliberating towards a solution, which if in a House structure, it wouldn't have that role.
Well, but I don't think you would necessarily... I think for the case of the Senate, you wouldn't just change the system of representation. You wouldn't just make it random selection of proportional, what do they call the...
Stratified?
No. When they do a layering of the brain, for instance, they take one layer at a time.
They cut sections.
Yeah. Oh,
technical name for it.
I know. It's where you put a little plate under the...
Yeah, those are sections. You're sectioning.
Biopsy?
Yeah, you're sectioning. No, I know, but there's another word for it.
I know.
Anyway, you ensure that there's some, that the Senate is proportionally composed in the same way that the society at large is composed. You wouldn't have it work like a Senate. You would have it work in some way like an assembly. They would probably have people presenting to them and then deliberating amongst themselves. They wouldn't have enormous support staff they wouldn't have party affiliations. They wouldn't have... All of these things would be completely different. I think that in that case, it could work perfectly fine as long as you don't expect it to work the way the Senate does now.
To end what Ido was saying, too, a question of scale, because we don't want to be in the danger of creating another level of political elite. So you have to have these proposals coming from below. So that requires an extreme, more holistic framework, right? Starting, you have the bottom, you have assemblies in each neighborhood, and then you have, so you have a level where these things can come from below and from top. So you have both. But I just think, just putting something at a national level is dangerous because it's creating more elites or a level of elitism. So
a random assembly doesn't create an elite.
But I think if you have
a counter elite,
there's a potential.
It's an elite.
But elite implies a set of interests that are distinct from the masses, and the whole point of this is to create a deliberative body that plays a central role within the collective decision-making over collectively important matters.
Right.
A deliberative body that is itself ordinary people rather than elites.
But you also have to have a mechanism that ensures that continuity and that deliberation. So, because once they're in a part, they will get addressed by different interest groups.
I mean, I guess what I was thinking was just that, but why not think about, rather than thinking about it as replacing an entire House of Congress, thinking about having distinct assemblies for distinct policy areas, so it's like a social policy assembly, and it would be a, trade assembly or whatever. And it just seems like the advantage of that is that there's just sort of a more intense discussion around a particular area where people are, and I didn't mean to imply that
the way that the U.S. Senate currently aggregates information
is
particularly
quality?
Commendable. but rather than say that you want an institution which does in fact do a good job of aggregating information, and it just seems like stretching people's capacity. And citizens are capable of having opinions and informed opinions, but I wouldn't, trust myself necessarily to decide on every single policy issue facing the federal government of the United States.
That's exactly why you're a desirable person to be in charge of these decisions, as opposed to, I would trust you as an uninformed and, non-biased individual than I would, say, even, I don't know, Nancy Pelosi? I don't know.
I think this is an interesting point. So what we have now, with respect to this idea of a random democracy, a random citizen assembly, is a component part of a system of representative power that somehow tries to combine ordinary citizens with representatives of one sort or another. So one idea was that it would simply function as a second house, a house of citizens. Todd's suggestion is that you'd actually, there'd be some virtue in having a half a dozen citizens' assemblies at whatever level of government we were talking about. So it could be a state government or it could be national government, that's a separate matter. But in which they'd be functionally distinct. So we'd have an environmental citizens' assembly, and we'd have a foreign policy citizens' assembly, and we'd have a social welfare citizens' assembly, or whatever. There'd be some list of functionally distinct domains of policy.
Committees and subcommittees in Congress.
Right. Congress would still have its, the elected Congress would still have its own structure, but this would be a parallel structure. And so that when a environmental legislation comes through Congress in the usual way that it does, it also has to go through the Environmental Citizens Assembly. So that would be another model, and an interesting one, and perhaps something that should be thought of as a design possibility for combining ordinary citizen. I guess it was Guillaume who made the point that the random assembly, the citizens' assembly, is more like trying to simulate direct democracy at higher levels of government rather than thinking of it as an alternative form of representation. That it is representative in this statistical sense, but the character of the deliberation is more like direct democracy, because it's ordinary people being directly engaged in the decision-making. And so possibly a set of functional assemblies could be another design that one could imagine for this kind of thing. Guillaume, and then...
I think it's a good proposal, perhaps, to have like different form of citizens' assembly, but I don't know if all issues should be treated with equal weight. The case of the electoral system is one where all citizens, that's kind of the thesis I would kind of submit. The case of the electoral system in BC is one where all citizens can democratically make an informed opinion. Whereas I think there could be issues like probably the environment where democracy is not a good option, where it would be preferable to have like a very stiff system and say, there won't be any environmental deregulation. This is not a democratic situation, or there's no democratic solution about that or deliberation.
But how do you decide that other than democratically?
It would be part of, let's say, no, it's just that the government seems to create these issues, right? For example, the Electoral Assembly was probably a project of the state. And at the same time, you could see that you could make the same argument about the environment. Say, the state is also the sole responsible author for ensuring that the environment is not degraded to a further level. It would not be beneficial to have an environmental assembly to say, perhaps, yes, it is.
But where I would disagree with that framing is when you say the state would decide that the environment should not be degraded, the state is more likely to decide it should be degraded. The best chance for a collective decision to maintain the environment is if it's deeply democratic. Because I think ordinary citizens, if if they deliberated and thought about these issues, would have a greater chance. They might screw up. I'm not saying that. There'd be a greater chance that they would weigh the interests of future generations than if state officials under current mechanisms by which they're selected and recruited were to make that decision.
It depends on the political system. Probably here, yes, but if you look like say when Hungary was under like a communist system, the forests and environment was highly regulated by a state, and not saying that we should go back.
Generally, the record of environmental protection of the authoritarian state command economies is pretty terrible. I mean, they may have been regulated, but they were environmentally destructive in general in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union.
Well, because of industrialization.
And because
but not forestation, let's say. Well, I just know about the case of Hungary. But.
Maybe Hungarian forests did well under authoritarian rule, but.
But I know the point is just to highlight, differences, right?
Well, I think, I don't know, I see the environment as less of an issue, but I do see something like gay rights or something that has like a would be much more problematic. Death penalty, like that sort of like social value based, would be really problematic in this type of
It's just
system.
That the environment is like a highly sensitive topic now.
Right, but I think
more.
Everyone could say that they want the environment intact, and I think that is not so with like gay rights and then you're also right. But I think so. You're assuming that the state does want to protect the environment, which I think.
Well, yeah, I'm kind of assuming. I'm making the assumption that not all issues should be brought in front of the citizens' assembly.
Are you really saying that there's a historical legacy that you don't want to put at risk? It's not really that the state has decided that we're going to protect the environment. It's that we've reached a point where states have sort of invested in environmental protection because of this historical legacy and that's been institutionalized, and now we don't want to potentially put those institutions on the chopping block. But I would say that this is the Hamas problem again. This is
I think that on most on a very broad range of problems, including the environment, the outcome of a deliberative process among ordinary citizens deciding on an equal basis is more likely to be progressive and far-sighted with a long time horizon than alternatives, including bureaucratic technocrats making this decision. So there may be an off case, there may be particular cases where a set of technocrats will make the best decision. It's possible. But on average, they will make less optimal decisions than democratic deliberation. Now, that's a distinct issue from the human rights, particularly around social and, quote, moral questions, lifestyle questions, around which, given the current distribution of values in the population, one would imagine that a process of democratic deliberation around things like same-sex marriage would be on average, more likely to be restrictive than a elite-driven process. And that's because these are particular kinds of issues in which we know that education produces a more tolerant and open set of values. And it's a bit of an illusion that these rights are protected by the state. They're protected by educated elites, who tend to be more tolerant around these issues, and educated elites have greater influence on courts and on, you know, politicians and whatever. Yeah, at least in some places in the world, in this benighted country, that doesn't seem. I think that does pose a tricky question. Is there a way of safeguarding individual rights of this sort and insulating it from democratic empowerment of whatever form, whether it be random assemblies or direct democracy or representative democracy? That's what things like bills of rights are supposed to do. But the Bill of Rights itself has to be endorsed democratically in order for it to have any legitimacy in force. So the, you know, there are historical moments where you can get people to democratically endorse a general Bill of Rights, but it's in a way a kind of trick. You know, you've gotten them to endorse it, hoping that they don't understand the full ramifications of what it is they're endorsing. Because then it turns out that it endorses a whole set of things which they wouldn't have endorsed, and if they knew that that was what was coming, they wouldn't have endorsed the initial Bill of Rights. I think we should move on to the participatory budget. We've talked a little bit about, you know, these things move from one to another, but let's talk more specifically about that institutional design, using the Porto Alegre case as a model, but just as the Citizens' Assembly could be used for all sorts of things other than electoral reform, I mentioned one, the Citizens' House. Todd introduced another, functional assemblies that are still randomly chosen. Another possibility for the Citizens' Assembly is this Washington State proposal for having a Citizens' Assembly to review all referenda, and for the Citizens' Assembly to vote on a referendum, which then becomes public information for citizens who vote on the referendum. And I think that's a pretty interesting kind of proposal in the context of places which have these referenda. Well, in a similar spirit, I think, the issues around the participatory budgeting are not just around this particular instance of a empowered participatory direct democracy that in this case does urban budgets, but one could imagine all sorts of other kinds of participatory councils in which various kinds of problem-solving activity could be organized in this kind of way. So the question then is what your assessment, your feelings about that design, the empowered participatory governance as represented by participatory budgeting. A lot of you had things to say about, in one way or another, about this. To read down the list, Ido, Eduardo, Molly, Ricardo, Ruth, Santiago, Song Ik, Pablo, Molly.
Is that like a nudge, wink, wink?
Yeah, nudge.
Yeah, my name was not on this. I'm not saying anything.
Well, I mean, the first thing I thought of, you answered fairly definitively in your response, and my question was whether it is possible and whether it is desirable to have participatory budgeting scaled up to a state or national level, and you said that it was tried in Brazil and that it was a disaster, more or less. So I would be curious to know why it was a disaster, if it was information problems, if the bottom-up system of deliberation was too large to manage, if by the time it got up to the top of this pyramid it had lost its representational character, what the problems were. I don't know if that's necessarily what we're talking about. But.
I don't know the reasons exactly for the failure of the participatory budget in the state of Rio Grande do Sul, which is the state that Porto Alegre is located in. And when the Workers' Party gained the governorship of the state, they attempted to create a state-level participatory budget. And it just didn't work very well, and it was, as far as I know, abandoned as an effort. What I don't know is if people weren't patient enough, because the participatory budget in Porto Alegre was a mess as well in the first couple of years. It took a while for people to figure out how to actually make it work, even at the municipal level. And it's possible that the stakes at the state level were too high to go through that experimental process. And that when it didn't work, it got killed off. I mean, that's a possibility. I don't know enough about the specific history. It's not so hard, though, to imagine why at a broader level, the number of different kinds of things which the budget has to deal with are quite different from in a city where there's these basic categories of services and amenities which ordinary citizens know all about because they interact with them all the time. So it's also possible that there's a complexity problem for budgeting, that as you move up to higher levels, it just gets too hard. But I don't actually have an answer to the question about why it didn't work.
What about the sustainability of the Porto Alegre experience? In 10 more years or 5 more years, so we don't have the Workers' Party anymore.
Well, the Workers' Party lost the last election in Porto Alegre, but not because of any problems with the participatory budget. In fact, the mayor, the party which won that election, has continued the participatory budget. They lost, as I understand it, they lost the Rio Grande do Sul election because there had been a corruption scandal at the state level, not at the city level, and as a protest against Lula, which people were disenchanted with, but that it didn't have that much to do with the local stuff.
But the fact that they kept participatory budgeting even under a party change is a good sign.
That's a good sign. Right. Now there's two issues around sustainability. One is just the formal sustainability of the institutional device itself, and the other is its how sustainable is its effectiveness. Some kinds of reforms have fantastically positive effects when they're young, because there's lots of enthusiasm, nobody's burned out yet, it's novel, people can do it for a few years and then stop doing it, but there's plenty of other people to come in and do it. So one could easily imagine a cycle for something like participatory budgeting, in which when it's introduced and the kinks get worked out, there's a lot of enthusiasm, public effervescence around it, lots of participation, and then people burn out and it begins to decline. And then because there's less enthusiasm, then it runs into all sorts of inefficiencies and problems, because there isn't the kind of diligence and vigilance needed for it to work well. And it's my impression that there's a little bit of that that's happened in Porto Alegre, in part intensified by a kind of paradox of successful democracy, which is that a successful democratic project like this accomplishes a lot, but the accomplishments lock in the budget. You know, so you build daycare centers, then you have to pay the staff, and you have to fix the roof, and you have to pay the electric bill. So the more successful you are in mobilizing resources to build infrastructure, the more future budgets are locked in by the ongoing legacies of past budgets. So what's happened in Porto Alegre is the discretionary part of the budget, the part of the budget that really is up for grabs, declines over time. In the early years of the participatory budget, that was compensated for by increasing taxes, so that the actual size of the budget was expanding faster than the lock-in. The increasing taxes for the budget in Porto Alegre came from two sources. One was increasing transfers from above. Brazil has a system of local revenues being in part redistributed from the center, from the national government to the state government and from the state government to the local government. So like in the United States, there are block grants and things like that from the federal government. And the other, I'm told, is that there was increasing tax compliance. People were simply paying their taxes more, partially because corruption went down and there was more willingness to pay taxes. Well, both of those have played out. That is, the transfers from above have declined because of austerity budgets. The lock-in has increased as the legacy of past infrastructure creates built-in costs, which of course in principle could be abandoned, but people don't. They tend to want to keep the buildings heated or lit that they previously built.
Imagine, yeah.
And therefore, I'm told that the energy and enthusiasm for the participatory budgeting process has declined because there just isn't that much revenues to distribute. Yeah.
Doesn't that sort of raise the problem of having a citizen, like a really good working, like citizens group, that only has control over a really limited sector of what they're deciding on. And in this case, it's not that limited, but the fact that they, I'm assuming, can't look at taxes or can't look at raising taxes and are just responsible for deciding on what that budget goes
right.
to may inform the question we had earlier about could we have sectoral assemblies, or could that be seen as one of the limits to this? Is at a certain point you got to go beyond the this is your task to be like, well, maybe this is the government.
I mean, the tax problem is, in a way, it's one of the fundamental problems of democracy in a capitalist system, because the capacity of democratic bodies of whatever sort, whether it be state or national or whatever, the capacity of democratic bodies to enact the democratic will depends upon their capacity to command resources.
Mm-hmm.
And if the availability of resources is derivative from the dynamism and stability of capitalism, so a precondition for having resources is that capital accumulation is going along fine.
Mm-hmm.
It means that democratic bodies have to attend to the vibrancy of capitalism in order to do whatever it is that they want to do. And that, I think, is what is generally thought of as the central structural constraint on democracy, imposed on democracy by virtue of being capitalist. And of course, those can be even more intense in a context like Brazil because of the global financial system and the dependency of Brazil on various global institutions, which may reduce the room to maneuver even within those kinds of constraints. So, I mean, one thing that people I know have been talking about, I don't know the extent to which it's actually happened, but one thing that people are talking about in Porto Alegre is having the participatory budgeting councils or assemblies be transformed into participatory planning councils, where there's a, whoops, it looks like...
Oh. Okay, no.
Are they still there, or...?
No,
we're still there.
We're still there.
Thank goodness.
That's a relief.
And it's somehow comforting to know that when the computer turns off, we still...
Yeah. Look, it's 6 o'clock. Why don't we take our break while we're... Let's take our break while we're re-connecting.
Just took it.
Okay.